Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you could listen today. During this hour of Focus 580, we will continue to explore the impact of information technology on the ways we work and live. Our guests are two scholars and researchers who call themselves critical friends of technology, critical in the sense of trying to make thoughtful and deliberate choices about using technology in light of human practices, goals, and values. Bonnie Nardi is an anthropologist and researcher at AT&T Labs Research, and Vicky O'Day is a computer scientist, formerly with the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, now pursuing graduate studies in anthropology at the University of California at Santa Cruz. They're both co-authors of a book we'll be discussing today entitled Information Ecologies, Using Technology with Heart, published by the MIT Press and out now in paperback. In the book Information Ecologies, our guests argue that our adoption of new technology is really in our own hands. When we buy into the notion that adoption of a given technology is inevitable, we give up important choices about how that technology is adopted. They say only by examining any given technology in the context of our own values, practices, and, as they term it, ecologies, can we be well prepared to make the best choices. We'll talk about that during this hour, and as we do so, we invite your phone calls. Questions and comments are welcome on the topic. Around Champaign-Urbana, you can call us at 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. That makes it easier to remember. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us. That includes on the Internet in the United States. If you're listening on the web, you can use our toll-free line and call us at 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Anywhere you hear us, 800-222-WILL. Vicky and Bonnie, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Great to have you both on the show.
Yeah, thank you.
Just to start, as you do in the book, with Fritz Lang's Metropolis, this great film, it's interesting because I actually had never seen that until I got your book, and it started with references to the film. So before I proceeded, I went out and rented it. And it's just a wonderful film that sort of it sort of illustrates this cleavage between technology and humanity in a very stark way.
We found it just amazing to watch.
Yeah.
We were recommended to the film by a friend who thought it was resonant with our themes, I guess, that we were talking about. And we went out and watched the film together, and we just found it visually breathtaking and also amazingly prescient about some of the issues that we're still talking about today.
This is a film that was produced in the 1920s, so it's, you know, maybe one that a lot of people aren't familiar with, but maybe I could ask you to you know, a sort of a thumbnail sketch of the basic theme.
Well, the movie is about a world in which there's beautiful, stunning technology that that manages a city above ground, and then underground there are workers running machines who basically make possible the life of the masters above ground who live in this stunning city. And it's a really simplistic plot and idealized characters.
But it sounds familiar.
And I guess that the images to us brought home some of the technologies that we use today. You see desktop video conferencing, you know, machines in this case that are physically beyond the workers' reach, that the workers are stretching to be able to move the dials and levers and wheels that they're required to move. But for us, that's consistent with our experience as office workers who are also, you know, feeling like our machines are sometimes a little bit beyond our reach. There's also this theme of time, that the machines are operating at a pace that requires people to speed up.
Yeah.
And I think we all recognize that feeling in the technologies that we use. So the plot of the movie continues with, you know, an explosion underground, the, you know, kind of a worker rebellion and destruction of the city. It goes on from there. I really recommend it. It's impossible to describe the impact of the film in
words.
And there's an overall theme of trying to unify heart, head, and hands that I found really, really compelling and then spoke to me about our relationship with technology and how we need to try to unify those forces more completely.
Yes, it is. It wraps up with a nice bow at the end, and presumably they're going to, you know, that particular dysfunctional society is going to work out its kinks and, you know,
right,
and move on.
Inspirational moment.
But yeah, your point about the workers, all the controls are just larger than they can actually reach, so they have to stretch and they have to, you know, work faster and faster just to keep up. And it does sound really familiar in these days that we have to adapt to the tech, particularly computers. You know, we're given these marvelous tools, but we find ourselves modifying our work practices.
That's right.
Drastically just to deal with them.
And getting sore wrists, being constantly interrupted by email and voicemail and so on.
Yeah, and I think people experience a lot of emotional stress just from feeling that they're not keeping up, that their technology is obsolete, that they don't really know how to use it, and they're always kind of behind the eight ball instead of feeling in control and feeling comfortable and congenial with the technology.
Yeah. Well, and again, you know, it's a sense, I think as we saw in Fritz Lang's film, and I think as many of us feel in working in our offices and shops and wherever it is we work, that the tools we're given, we must use them. We must learn them, and we simply have to adopt and adapt to these tools as a sort of matter of inevitability. And this is something that you call attention to early on in the book that I wanted to ask you to talk about, the rhetoric of inevitability, whether it's good or bad, whether it's a hype or a nightmare that we're describing. If we buy into that rhetoric, we give up important choices.
Yeah, I think the problem with that rhetoric is that it's really disempowering because it says the technology is coming, it's coming in the form that big companies deliver it to you in, and you have to take it and adapt to it. And there's no sort of opening for people to say, well, this is how I would like to use the technology, and I would like to have more human support for the technology. It's just kind of thrown out there, and we're supposed to pick it up and use it and be technically proficient immediately, and people just are not like that, and as I said, it leads to stress and to people not using the tools to their fullest capacity as well.
We hear often in the press about how the information revolution is just accelerating, and of course it is, and it sort of gives the sense of this accelerating iceberg that is just going to level the ground. And it's something that is larger than us and that we really can't control. It's just going to happen. Is that perhaps putting it a little bit too simplistically?
I think there is rhetoric along those lines, and that's part of what we want to draw attention to and resist in the book. Because while it's certainly true that there are global market forces and global technology decisions that affect us in ways we can't directly control, one of our main points is that we do have choices about whether and how we take up technology and how we appropriate it to use it for our own ends. It's not true that everybody has all the choices all the time, but our point is that if we pay attention to the local settings that we belong to the schools that we attend to, that we attend or that our children attend, to the offices we work in, to the places that we go, we have choices on a very local scale, where local means different things for different people in different situations. And so we want to shift perception, for a moment anyway, away from the global forces and toward the local decision-making that people do, because we think that there's a lot of opportunity there. That's where activism can happen. That's where creativity can happen in how people take up technology.
So in other words, you would argue it's not just a matter of policy and politics.
No. I mean, certainly that's present, and it's present at the local level as well as at the larger levels.
Sure.
But it is debilitating to believe that you can't speak up and ask questions, and there are surprising effects when you do. I mean, it turns out that people can have a tremendous impact in their local environment.
Yeah, I think it's a mistake to always say, well, that's a policy issue, that's something for the politicians to deal with. It's really not something that I have control over because, as Vicki said, you're surprised sometimes when you actually say, well, let's try to make this technology fit into our local setting and see what we want to do with it. I think people can do more than they often think they can.
Yeah. This is a situation where I can't direct questions to looking at each of you with eye contact, so I have to sort of maybe ask you to maybe identify yourself, as you just did, Bonnie, thank you, and feel free to say whatever you want to say in response to my question. You can either or both of you jump in, and I'm not sure quite how to direct it other than that, so just to get that out of the way,
okay.
Feel free to speak. But following up on your last point, I think many of us, or most of us, sometimes buy into the notion that when it comes to discussions about technology, especially computers and, you know, this whole digital revolution, the only role an individual can really play is as a consumer. You buy either this product or that product, and that's what decides which product survives the battle of the fittest in the marketplace. You know, is this a way of disempowering ourselves or what? I mean, we have many roles, not just consumer.
I think it's important here, the perspective that we bring is people who go out and do workplace studies, usually as part of technology design teams. But the point is that we go out to where people work with technology and use it in schools and in offices and libraries and hospitals and other places. And we pay attention not just to the people and the keyboards and the screens, but to as much of the surrounding context as we can, and by that we mean the other technologies, including low-tech technologies such as, you know, pencils and paper and whiteboards and telephones. We pay attention to the social interactions between people. What's getting done in and around the technology? And I think that when you look with that perspective, you see just an astonishing diversity, even in supposedly similar settings, say in schools, an astonishing diversity in how people have positioned technology, where they put computers, how they schedule access to them, what kinds of help and support systems are in place. And in our view, those decisions of how technology is positioned and used are just as much a kind of design process as whatever it is that packaged the hardware and software for sale in the first place. And so if we think about design in this broader way, we can see that the consumers are also designers of technology and have many positive decisions to make about its use.
Right, and we also wanted to offer the ecology metaphor as an alternative to the consumer metaphor, which is the one that we're typically presented with, to get people to think systemically, to think about, if I place this television in my living room, how will it affect me and my family? If I bring this computer into the school, what will happen to the teachers and the students and everybody else involved? If I bring a new word processor into the office, it's not just what are the features that this particular software program has, it's how does this affect the entire setting that we're working in? And so what Vicki and I really would like is for people to think about those questions as well as the more narrowly focused consumer questions as they approach technology.
This is the area I wanted to talk about next because I think that the metaphors that we use to describe the things that we do are important in the way that we think about those things. And as you point out, the metaphors for technology vary depending on one's perspective. We often describe computers in particular as tools. Yeah. And maybe I could ask you to talk about these different metaphors and how they affect our thinking. The tool metaphor in particular is something that is very common.
This is Vicki. Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, I remembered that time. Absolutely. In fact, we grappled a lot with some material that we wanted to talk about and finally realized that what we were talking about was metaphor. Some of our writing process was definitely discovery. As people who've lived and worked in design settings and technology settings for a lot of years, we're so used to talking about technologies as tools that it really feels like a synonym. I mean, what else could it be? Of course it's a tool. And we don't think about the metaphorical properties of that image and where it leads us. So we tried to step back and take it apart a little. And I must say that when I talk about with this metaphor idea with technology friends, you know, they have the same reaction that we did initially, that, you know, it is what it is. It's not a metaphor at all. But when you step back and look at the notion of tool as a metaphor, one of the places it leads is to thinking about individuals, holding on to singular objects. You know, we think about car keys and screwdrivers and, you know, ice cube tongs and all sorts of everyday tools. And we think of then a computer or a piece of software as a similar kind of thing, something that we can pick up and put down at will, something that has useful properties that extend what we can do in interesting ways. And that's good. In technology design settings, one place that leads is thinking hard about what properties the tools have, what makes them useful, what can make them more useful. It leads to good testing of fit between users and their tools. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't encourage us at all to think about broader social and political and organizational questions. It just doesn't go there. So one thing that we want to do is pay very, very close attention to the language that we have about technologies and to try and stretch the language that we use to encompass other metaphors and see where they go. So we've talked also about technology as a system, for example, which is where Fritz Lang's film Metropolis takes us. It's really something that is so vast and so pervasive and so entwined in everyday life that it controls us rather than the other way around. And this, too, has some resonance with our experience, as we discussed before. The problem is that we see only the global and not the local. So that's what took us in the direction of ecology. It was to try on another metaphor in a kind of a purposeful way and see where it might take us.
So the ecology metaphor kind of sits between the tools and the system. So with the tools, we're perfectly in control and we're holding the hammer in our hand and we know what we're doing with it. And with the system, there are these large global forces that we know are important, but we are sort of a cog in a larger system. And the ecology is a local setting in which individuals are still important, but it's not a single individual. It's an individual with other people and with other tools. And that's where we feel there's a lot of leverage for everyday, ordinary people to say, okay, what is my personal relationship to technology in this particular setting? And to be more reflective and to take some action.
As anthropologists, does that help you look at a given setting in a different way?
Yeah, as anthropologists, that's kind of what we're trained to do from the get-go, and so it feels very natural to us. And what Vicki and I wanted to do was find a metaphor that we felt would convey a lot to the general public, and most people are familiar with ecology from biology and so forth, and there are a lot of nice systems concepts behind the ecology metaphor. So it's not one that we would maybe typically use as anthropologists, but it fits very nicely into our training and experience.
Let's talk about the aspects of this metaphor of information ecologies. You break it down in several ways of sort of exploring what this is, what this concept is. Co-evolution being one of those.
Let me just back up for one moment and say that we should clarify that we don't intend for this ecology metaphor or any of the metaphors to be taken completely literally. Okay. So we want to borrow from it liberally, but it is still a metaphor, and we want to pick up things that will suggest useful avenues of discussion. So the co-evolution idea is just the observation that in a system of related and interacting things, when some kind of change is introduced, different aspects of the system respond. So if we introduce a change, for example, in the technology that's present in a classroom, some of the other related practices in the classroom will need to respond, such as scheduling of time during the day, such as teaching practices, such as reorganization of the physical space, such as perhaps curriculum, perhaps assessment, that there's no way of thinking about the technology in isolation from the related features of the ecology. So we want to point that out because there's a very natural tendency, especially when people are either making technology design decisions or technology deployment and implementation decisions, to think about it in isolation because it's simpler. It's much, much easier to get your mind around a technology if you're thinking about it separated from its context. And we want to point out that while that is at times convenient, there are other times when you need to look specifically at the relationships of this technology to its context.
And I just wanted to say that Vicki and I defined an information ecology as people, practices, technologies, and values. So what we wanted to do was kind of raise consciousness about how values come into play, how practices come into play. And again, to go back to your point about consumerism, it's not just the individual and a set of features that they're trying to assess before they buy a technology. There's much, much more to it than that.
We're almost at our midpoint. Let me just reintroduce our guests this morning. During this hour, Focus 580, we're talking with Bonnie Nardi and Vicki O'Day. They are co-authors of a book we're discussing, Information Ecologies, Using Technology with Heart, published by the MIT Press and out now in paperback. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455 or our toll-free line anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. In any given setting where, you mentioned schools, where computers have been introduced, obviously that is going to change a lot of things, especially if there's suddenly a mandate. We're going to start using these computers. And then suddenly you have to have technical support, and you have to have some training for the teachers, and the students have to learn. You studied several situations where this was in fact happening. There was a very interesting sort of virtual space called Pueblo, and also the Lincoln High School in San Jose, California. And I wonder if you can talk about your observations in either or both of these settings where computers are being integrated with traditional school activities.
Right. Yeah, the schools were really interesting. And Vicki and I were really fascinated to see how much the kids got out of the technology, which is certainly not always the case. Yeah. And I think the secret of why it worked so well in these two particular schools was that the teachers who brought the technology into the schools knew why they were doing it. So one of the points that we make in information ecologies is that we need to ask more know-why questions, not just know-how. How do we get these networks, you know, into these classrooms? But why are we bringing these computers into these classrooms? Why are we wiring the school? What do we hope to accomplish? So at Lincoln High School, which is where I did research, this is Bonnie, the teacher really wanted to improve her art curriculum. She is a very talented amateur photographer, and she thought there's a wonderful opportunity here for the kids to do something with digital photography and learn about technology at the same time. So her focus in the class was always on art, and the technology just came along to support the digital photography, but it was not the main focus of the class. And so I think that was why the class was so successful. And that's what I would like to see more of in the schools, is people asking the know-why questions. Because once those are settled, and of course they change over time, but once they're settled, at least initially, decisions get made that support the use of the technology in much more fruitful ways. But often we just say we have to have computers in the schools,
yeah.
And it leads to a lot of frustration and computers sitting on desks and kids going to typing classes instead of using computers in really creative, interesting ways which they can be used in.
What was interesting to read about that scenario is a lot of the students signed up for the class because they had no interest in computers in particular. Maybe they got interested in computers, mm-hmm. but they wanted to do photography.
Yeah, exactly, right. And I thought that was really the right thing, is that this is really an art class, it's a photography class, and we can get the students who have those interests, and then if they learn some technology along the way, that's excellent. But we're not just throwing the technology at them.
This is Vicki, and I can say
sure.
a bit about the Pueblo experience,
yeah.
which was different. This was a project that was between Xerox PARC, the research center in Palo Alto, and a low-income setting elementary school in Phoenix, Arizona, with a very large population of kids, many of whom were learning English as a second language when they came to school. And Pueblo, as you mentioned, was an online community which brought together kids across different grades and ages in the elementary school, senior citizens in the Phoenix area who were interested in learning to use computers and who were interested in interacting with children, brought them together, plus other adults, including the researchers and teachers, in an online space in which they created fanciful environments and did a lot of writing, because this online space was entirely constructed out of text. So it was fundamentally a reading and writing activity, but it was also a very social one. And there's much more to say about it. It was a very interesting community to be part of and to observe. But what made it work for the school were several key things. One was that it was very much, from the very outset, a joint project between the outside computer science researchers and the elementary school. Decision-making about what the space should be and how it should be used was completely shared. This was a lot of overhead, in some sense, for the computer scientists that they were not used to. People are much more used to going off and being able to design on their own and then deliver something that's already fully designed. And it required an enormous time investment and substantial sharing of responsibility and design creativity across the team. Another thing that made it successful was that this online space was conceived as an extension of the school in the same sense that, you know, the library was part of the school. This online space was conceived as an extension of the school in a very profound way, so that the values of the school were explicitly reflected into Pueblo, the guidelines for behavior, the guidelines for what they called in the school rights and responsibilities, which was lingo that they used in the classroom, was as much a part of Pueblo as it was of the classroom setting. So students were asked to help one another. They were asked to be cooperative and generous and all of the things that they were expected to do in their everyday student life. So it wasn't thought of as a technology that was prepackaged and came with its own rules and regulations, but it was thought of as something that the school must shape to fit its own style.
Well, Vicki, let me ask you to talk a bit more about how the students responded and what they got out of Pueblo. And I assume, is it still ongoing?
Well, it's quiescent now, okay. And that draws attention to one of the things that's crucial to understand about technology in schools, and you've already pointed it out, and that's the ongoing support.
Yeah.
You mentioned technical support. In addition, there's an important kind of social support that has to happen. There have to be people who are excited about the technology and knowledgeable about teaching and can build bridges across those two disciplines. And in the case of Pueblo, some of those people left the school and went on to other jobs for reasons of their own. Also, we were grant-funded through generous government grants, but grants naturally end. And when those grants ended, the teachers lost some of the support for doing summer workshops and for release time during the year. And this may seem like, sort of mundane, nitty-gritty stuff, but it's lifeblood of a technology implementation effort in the school, that teachers have time to experiment with it, to learn about it, and to make teaching decisions about it. So Pueblo is quiescent now. As to what people learned, well, it's hard to put your finger on it. We did various assessments about reading and writing, and they were rather inconclusive. My own very strong personal feeling from spending lots of time at the school and with the kids was that there was an impact, but it may not be measurable, which is the kind of impact that schools prefer to have. and the kind of impact that I saw had to do with this particular population of kids. These were kids who were not going to have access to technology at home and for whom, to use a very overworked word, this was just extremely empowering. I mean, this technology was theirs. It belonged to them. They could do with it things that of their own invention. They quickly became more knowledgeable than their teachers. there was just this tremendous simmering excitement from the kindergartners on up. The school opened its doors at 6 in the morning, and the kids would run into the library and log on to Pueblo. So I don't know how to measure that kind of thing, but I certainly believe it's real, and I think it was an important feature of the project.
So it sounds like in this particular ecology, a hurricane came through or something, or the oxygen got sucked out of it because, the funding dried up or something like that.
Maybe the funding dried up, and it could have continued. It actually had a history that predated the funding. So it began as a grassroots effort on donated equipment from local companies and so on, and then it got an influx of funding, and then the funding left. And I think, it might be more accurate to say that many of these kinds of technologies and experiences have their own life cycle.
Yeah.
and they don't have to be the same everywhere, but it may have been just kind of a natural time for it to wind down, because it does take a tremendous amount of work to keep that kind of thing going. The teachers were meeting regularly on their own. We were having design meetings once a month. We were doing lots of writing about our experiences. And in the thick of an everyday teacher's life, that's a very demanding thing to take on.
It seems to me, as we talk about computers in the classroom and this big effort to get computers in the classroom, I mean, it's almost like the politicians, and I'm not knocking anyone here, perhaps, but, you know, simply the solution to education and technology is to throw computers in the classroom. It's a very simplistic way to go about it.
Yes, I completely agree. I think that's what Vicki and I both saw in the classrooms that we studied, was that it does take a tremendous effort in terms of designing a curriculum that makes sense for the students. And in terms of keeping the whole thing going, it takes a lot of commitment and a lot of money and a lot of time. And if you don't have those ingredients, you're just going to have computers sitting on the desk, and maybe the kids will play a few games, and maybe they'll log on to the Internet. But it's not a rich, wonderful educational experience as it can be when you have those kinds of commitments.
Mm-hmm. And the thing is, those commitments can't come just once at the outset. They have to be there on an ongoing basis. The technology is changing. The teachers are learning more about what the technology is and how it's good for their students as they go, and they need to be continually modifying their curriculum as they go. So it's an ongoing time commitment at every level.
Right, and another thing is that the teachers themselves need a lot of support. One of the things that I did after we had done that study of the digital photography class was with some colleagues at Apple, we created an online course for teachers of digital photography, where they could come and talk to other teachers in other places who are trying to do the same kinds of things, because often there's only one or maybe two teachers in an individual school, and they feel isolated and they don't know how to solve certain problems, and they just need some support from other people. So the online course we thought was really successful in bringing teachers together to talk about the issues and use the technology more fruitfully within their own schools.
We have just about 15 minutes left with our guests, Bonnie Nardi and Vicki O'Day, co-authors of the book Information Ecologies, and would welcome any phone calls that you'd like to make in the remaining time. Otherwise, I'll just keep firing away. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, 800-222-9455. I want to ask you to talk about this concept in the metaphor of information ecologies. You use the term keystone species, which is, you know, again, a term from biology, but perhaps is an important one to think of in these other contexts.
Right. Vicki and I both have studied reference librarians, and we were really struck by how much value they provided to their clients. So there's all this information out there, and we're always talking about how we're drowning in information and we don't know how to find it, how to wade through it once we've got it. And the librarians that we studied were just extremely helpful to their clients in getting them the right information in a timely manner and weeding out things that they knew were not going to be useful for their clients, and being very, very helpful in kind of overcoming the frustrations of trying to deal with the glut of information. And so we see librarians as what we call a keystone species in the information age. And yet we talk about getting rid of librarians because now we have the Internet and everything is just out there.
You can just do a search.
Hmm?
As if a search is a very simple thing to do.
Yeah, just, you know, go to Yahoo or whatever and you can find what you're looking for. But, of course, that isn't really what information finding is all about. And so we feel in any ecology it's good to identify the keystone species and try to understand precisely what their contribution is and how you can keep it in the system, even though, of course, things are always changing. So now that the Internet is important, Vicki and I look at librarians and we say, okay, well, how can we take advantage of their skills and knowledge with this new set of information resources that we have? Not how can we throw them away, but how can we make them even more useful than they have been in the past?
The librarians that I talk with here at the university are some of the people on the cutting edge of research into computers and organizing information.
Completely. I mean, mm-hmm. I think librarians, you know, may go into their work because they're curious and interested and wonderful at learning about and communicating about many, many different kinds of disciplines and fields of information. And it's just such a terrific skill that we need more than ever on the Internet. A general point about keystone species and librarians is that Bonnie and I have noticed, not just in the library but in other settings, that people who we think of as keystone species are often people who can bridge gaps, who can mediate across boundaries, who have a leg in different worlds. And, you know, such a thing may not show up on somebody's resume. It might not be part of their job description. But in thriving ecologies, such people are present. And often their work may be invisible to, you know, the average participant in the ecology. And the library example is a good one there, because while librarians know among their own community what they do, one of the things that was very interesting about Bonnie's and my research in libraries was how clearly their clients did not know what librarians did. Even the closest, most regular clients who had their favorite librarians they went back to time and again didn't really have a picture of how much expertise and knowledge, including knowledge about the client's own particular interests and businesses, the librarians were bringing to bear in doing searches. And what that points to is the danger of making decisions about technology based on the visible work.
Mm-hmm.
I think it reminds us that when we're making decisions about technology, we should also look, you know, around the edges and across the borders and try and probe and see what's going on here that's not in anybody's job description, that may be relatively invisible, but in fact is crucial to the successful running of our ecology.
You refer to these people as gardeners?
I had done some research many years ago, actually, on how people support others in their office using spreadsheets and CAD systems, and because these are big, complicated software programs, especially CAD systems. And one of the local terms that people used in one of the companies I studied was gardeners. And so they had their favorite people who were, as Vicki said, they were bridgers. So they had a combination of social and technical skills. They were domain experts themselves, so they weren't consultants or trainers brought in to help you learn how to use the software. They were people who knew, I'm trying to design that flange. Now, what do I do with this darn program now to get it to do what I want? So they understood the domain, and they were also very conversant with the technologies, and they were tremendously helpful. And in the settings that we studied, finally the managers had started to realize that, and they had started to reward people. So as Vicki said, often this kind of work is invisible. This kind of work had started to become more visible, and managers had started to say, okay, great, you can spend 25% of your time supporting everybody else in the office, and that will be considered in your performance review, and thanks for doing that. That's great. And so we would like to see a lot more of that kind of thing, where people with these wonderful combinations of social and technical skills get rewarded for that. And I think it would make technology use much more congenial for everybody.
I think we've all experience, or probably most of us, especially if we work in offices with computers, that there are certain people who you just know you go to if you're having a problem with a particular program or an operating system or whatever it is you're using. And I think a lot of times those people, as you say, aren't appreciated. Their work is more or less invisible, perhaps, to management. But maybe that's one of the things that needs to happen, is that greater recognition be given to the people who, as you say, cross those bridges or have feet in both worlds, the technical and the actual implementation of the technical in the subject matter that is the purpose for being there.
Yeah, exactly. That's the kind of thing that can come out of looking at your setting ecologically, so focusing on the particular practices and trying to make them visible and bring them to light so you can see how people really are managing to use the technologies that they have, and then rewarding people accordingly.
Well, there are a bunch of other things I wanted to ask you to talk about. Among them was the example of the dysfunctional ecology at a teaching hospital, which you describe in one of the chapters of the book. And maybe I could ask you to talk about, what was the setting there and what happened that made it kind of go awry?
Right. Okay, so this was a teaching hospital, and there was neurosurgery was the setting, and there was an interesting, very innovative video system that was being used so that the operation could be broadcast to other parts of the hospital. So other surgeons or other interested parties didn't actually have to be in the OR to see the operating room to see what was going on. And often the surgeon was looking through a microscope, and so even within the OR, He was the only one who could see what was going on down in the brain or the spine during the neurosurgery. And so this video view of the surgery gave people a sense of what was actually going on and what the surgeon was doing or about to do. And so this was all fine and dandy until it turned out that the audio from the operating room was also being broadcast to remote parts of the hospital. And the people in the operating room didn't realize that, in particular, the nurses and the neurophysiologists. The neurophysiologists are people who monitor all kinds of bodily things like your heart rate and so forth and make sure that everything is going okay during the surgery. And so in the OR, there's a lot of banter. There's a lot of jokes. There's a lot of very informal talk that to an outsider sounds like these people aren't really doing their job. You know, this is brain surgery, and they're telling a joke that they heard last Friday. And so there was a lot of potential for misinterpretation as the audio got broadcast outside of the operating room. And people became very, very upset about this. The nurses were worried about, often there are students in the operating room, and they thought, you know, these students are not going to feel comfortable learning this very difficult skill if what they say is broadcast, and they don't know who is listening. So this led to a big brouhaha in the hospital, and it was because, I think, people didn't say, this is our local setting, we're introducing a new technology, let's sit down together and think about all the ramifications of broadcasting both the visual image and the audio. So that's where the ecology just kind of took off on its own without people being deliberate and reflective about how the technology would impact different players.
So what happened is that the positive value of the system for the neurosurgeon or the person monitoring, I forget exactly the different
neurophysiologist
monitoring the video and audio new devices that were introduced in these operating rooms, that was a positive value for the neurophysiologist.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not ever presented to the people in the operating room who often they relieve stress. I mean, it's a very difficult circumstance for them to be working in, and just, you know, casual banter is one way people have of relieving that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so there it became a negative value for those people.
Right, exactly. And part of the problem was that people just simply didn't know what was happening, and so they felt here was a new technology coming in with very profound implications, and I have no control over it. I have not been asked about my opinion. And so there were actually some interesting technical workarounds that came to light once these discussions took place. But the cost was that people became very upset, and that I felt that the process was not as smooth as it could have been.
Okay. Well, let me ask you then to talk in about the 5 minutes we have remaining about how you go about evolving a healthy information ecology. What are the things that you should think about and do before or while implementing some new arrangement?
Well, this is Vicki. One of the key things that Bonnie and I think is important is opening up a space for asking questions. One of the things that we talk about is strategic questions, questions that have leverage, and in particular, opening up a space in which many different kinds of people can ask questions. So in the hospital setting, for example, if nurses and anesthesiologists as well as neurophysiologists have been able to ask questions, there might have been a very different outcome and the brouhaha might have been averted. There are questions that just allow the participants in the ecology to describe to themselves what are their values here, what are they after, why are they contemplating a technological change, what do they hope to achieve. Just putting that out on the table can allow people to discover differences that they might, might not have understood were there. They might have different assumptions going in that can be exposed just by asking powerful questions. Questions about motivations are good. Questions about strategies. You know, what do we need to be successful in this endeavor? And this can expose different kinds of experience that people bring from very different settings where, for example, they saw the positive impact of a gardener and can bring that to light in a new setting. But just the notion of asking questions and what this implies that can be awfully hard is taking time. We talked already about how rushed we might feel as individuals in responding to our technology, and of course on an institutional level, people feel just as rushed. I mean, they feel like they have to get the technology in now. They have to make good decisions now, lock in prices now. And to do this well really requires time and reflection and revisiting decisions and not making them just once. So I think that what Bonnie and I suggest is a measured and open and fluid approach to technology that allows people to discover and revisit their decisions.
Yeah, so kind of in a nutshell, I would say seeing our relationship with technology as a social process and not just as a consumer decision.
That's a really interesting way to put it. The and we're in the 2 minutes or so remaining, maybe 3 minutes at the most. The internet is an area we haven't talked about, but this is, you lead right into that, Bonnie, because this is something that is increasingly considered mandatory for organizations and maybe even individuals to be engaged in is we got to have a website, now we're part of this huge system, and we don't have any choice. We have to rush. We have to do it.
Right. Well, I'm certainly all in favor of websites, but I think, again, taking this more measured, reflective, ecological kind of approach will probably lead to better websites, if nothing else, so that people think about, why do I want to have this website? Whose needs is it serving? Whose input do I need? There are often many voices that come together in an ecology, and that's part of what Vicki and I have been trying to say, is that it's not just an individual, it's a group of people in some particular setting with some particular values and goals. So, again, thinking more reflectively about how the website will serve those who create it and those who would be using it.
You mentioned the idea of strategic questioning in any of this. How do you go about that?
I think that depends on the local setting. I think it's Chapter 6, Vicki and I present a set of questions that we think might help people get started. But, of course, in every setting, people have their own processes. And I think reflecting on, do we have a process that might work to get us talking about technology? And if not, how could we invent a new process? I think often people don't think about inventing new social processes for their local settings. We think lots about bringing new technologies in. We're very focused on that. That's very salient. But we don't always think about maybe something that is lacking here. Maybe the omission is not a particular technology, but a particular social process. And going back to the point about co-evolution, maybe the introduction or potential introduction of a new technology is a great time to evolve a new social process so that people think about how can we come together around this technology and maybe get some community building out of it at the same time.
Well, that's a wonderful place to leave it, and since we're here at the end of our time, we will leave it there. And I will suggest for folks, if you'd like to read more, I've run into, by the way, a lot of people from the Graduate School of Library and Information Science who are familiar with this book. I'm sure you can find it in bookstores and probably the libraries as well. the book is Information Ecologies, Using Technology with Heart. The authors are Bonnie Nardi and Vicki O'Day, who have been our guests for this hour. It's published by MIT Press. And Bonnie and Vicki, thank you very much for talking. It's been very interesting.
Yeah, thank you, Jack. We appreciate it.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.